This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 17 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. In today's episode, we chat with author and sexpert Gloria Brame. Here's our hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thank you, Max. And here we go on another round of the Kinky Cast. Sitting across the table, as usual, is the Beast. Hey, Beast, what's happening tonight?
Good evening, Woody. I think that spring is finally here, or did we skip spring and go straight to summer? I'm not sure.
It's gorgeous out there.
It is that. With us tonight, we have in the studio Kate Kinsey, who has done a couple of shows with us, as the author. But Kate tonight is bringing us a great interview. And Kate?
I am so excited about our guest tonight because this is the woman who literally wrote the book on BDSM and fetish sex. And I am talking about none other than Dr. Gloria Brame, author of Different Loving, which is many consider the definitive academic text on BDSM and fetishism. Welcome, Gloria. We are thrilled to have you here.
Well, thanks, guys, and thank you for the generous introduction.
I don't think it's overly generous. I got to get this out of the way first. Different Loving was the first nonfiction BDSM book that someone put in my hands, and it answered so many of my questions, and so you are at least partially responsible for the pervert that I am today.
Boy, that's high praise.
Yeah, whoa. So I'm very grateful to you.
And let me say thank you.
I'm really, really happy that the book has done what we had hoped it would do, which is to really get BDSM out of the closet. It's not like I invented it or anyone, you know, of my generation invented it or even of prior generations invented it. It had always been around. And as a very open-minded and sexually liberated person always my whole life, when I actually found out I was into BDSM, although it was not what I expected, I mean, I didn't realize I was, you know, until I came to terms with it. But once I did, I felt good about it, and then I felt really sorry and sad for what I saw as an immense amount of suffering and shame and confusion and people just thinking they're bad people for being kinky because that's what they'd all been told.
Yeah, yeah.
What really inspired me to write the book is that I had started out as just a playful, pervy dominatrix on a chat room on the internet in like 1984 with outrage fantasies and just being my outrageous self. And then I ended up getting recruited into and founding a BDSM section on CompuServe, and that was like in 1987. Because I was hooked up with technology from like the very old days, like when it was all bulletin boards and stuff like that. So, and when I got on CompuServe, you know, I thought, how many BDSMers could there be out there, right? I thought there were like a couple of hundred of us.
Maybe. Boy, were you surprised.
You know? Yeah, you know, I thought it was like, all right, there are like 40 of us in New York who I always see at the club.
Oh, dear.
You know? I mean, how many more? And then what happened is, you know, it's sort of the build it and they'll come, you know? Once I had a BDSM support group, the numbers were just astronomical. You know, I mean, not for by today's standards. By today's standards, it's nothing. You know, it grew to like 70,000. But in those days when, you know, maybe a couple of million people all told were on the internet, it was huge, you know. And there was, I saw, such a need for genuine information and genuine understanding about what this was, because these were the days, you know, back in the late 80s when, you know, Ted Bundy claimed he was an S&M-er, and everybody was like, oh, my God, I'm like Ted Bundy, you know.
And that was back when the diagnosis was still that it was a mental disease.
Exactly. It wasn't that long ago, I know, but that was the late 80s for you and even into the early 90s. So sad to me. I mean, it was just so unbelievable how many people, for example, were closeted and felt like terrible human beings or completely paranoid they'd be arrested or outed and lose their jobs and all of those kinds of fears. You know, after leading that group and so many people saying, oh my God, you make it sound okay. I was like, it is okay, you know? It really is okay. It's okay as long as you're doing it, you know.
Safely, sanely, and consensually?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much, I would say, you know, if you're doing it for the right reasons, meaning you're not doing it to make other people miserable, but rather to have sexy, exciting, wonderful experiences, then it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, then everything else is moralizing, really.
Gloria, we've been taught our whole life that sex is dirty and all that. And as soon as you get thoughts that are start to be kinky, then everything starts to crumble unless you get a support group.
That's very much what the experience is for everyone who's sexually unusual, whether they're transgendered or transsexed or gay or lesbian or bisexual or kinky or fetishistic or whatever it is. You know, everybody grows up feeling marginalized because we're told that there's only this one way that's normal. And therefore, that's the only way everybody should be. And if you are not happy with that, something must be mentally wrong with you.
Mm.
You know, whereas I come from the point of view of if you're not happy with it, maybe it's because it's not right for you.
Exactly.
Maybe what would be right is something that gives you the joy that you really seek in life.
I think we've figured out when Kinsey started doing his research, we started figuring out just how much your self-esteem is tied into feeling okay about your very basic sexual drives.
Absolutely, Kate. You know, I have a volume 2 of The Truth About Sex is called Sex for Grown-Ups, and it's really for grown-ups. I don't think anyone under 25 should even bother reading it. I think it's really for people who've had sex quite a bit, hopefully, and who have been surprised to find out it's nothing like they thought it was when they were 12 and 16. When you deal with sex and you're a sexually active person in the real world and you have adequate numbers of partners, one thing you're inevitably going to notice is that variety is the norm and diversity is the norm.
That's a very good point, yes.
Yeah, everybody likes a little bit different. I mean, not saying that everyone is kinky, and certainly we're not all kinky in the same ways, but you know, this one likes it in the ass, and that one doesn't like you to go anywhere near the ass, and the other one is like, spend extra time on my feet. And this is even in straight relationships, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking back to my sexual partners even before I got into kink. It's like, yes, you're exactly right. There are so many variations. You never know what you're going to find when you go home with a different partner.
Right. And, you know, one of the interesting evolutions in the scene, having been at this for 30 years, is like when I started out, it was like, if you could just find somebody who was kinky, you would do your scene and you would compromise, because at least being with somebody who kind of got you, even if they didn't share your scene, was a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, with so many tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, it would seem, around the world who are into this, you can really specialize. You can go after exactly what you want.
You can find somebody who's into having sex wearing rubber with a zucchini, on certain days. And there's
and
probably
only comes when you rub their knee. And you can find, you know, 5 of them.
Exactly.
I thought it was just Kate that was that kind of kinky.
Meet Dr. Gloria Braham.
There's probably, I figured out very early on, there's probably, if you can imagine it, there's probably a website out there where somebody's doing it for money.
And one thing I've told, you know, not so much today, but like in the beginning when I was counseling and there weren't as many of them, you know, I would tell people, they go, oh, I have this fetish. I go, well, I know a lot of people have it, but there are no websites. I said, start one. If you start a website or you start a discussion group, I guarantee 3 months from now, you'll have a lot of people there.
You'll have all kinds of kinky friends.
Yes, you will. Because none of us really are alone in the world. You know, it's sort of a really positive message. All of us are different. None of us are alone, really.
Now, I want to back up just a little bit, just in case we have some newbies out there who are tuning in, because we get a lot of listeners who are new to the scene and or maybe somebody who's been under a rock for 30 years. And doesn't know exactly who you are. I want to make sure they understand that this is Dr. Gloria Braham. You have a PhD in human sexuality. You're not just somebody who came in off the street and said, I want to talk
about
this.
No, I have a PhD in human sexuality and a master's in public health and a master's in English.
You are an extremely qualified person.
My dissertation project was BDSM. So I'm probably, you know, when it comes to those credentials, I'm really proud of them because they're pretty solid for what I do. You know, don't ask me to step outside of this realm, but, you know, when it comes to sex, yeah.
Well, that's one of the great things about your first book, Different Loving, and everything you've written since, because I should point out, you mentioned a little bit about sex for grown-ups. Different Loving came first.
Different Loving was my first book, and I wrote it with my husband and a third author, John Jakes.
Yes, and you and your husband, I believe you told me, are still happily married?
Very happily married. 25.
That's great.
We survived a collaboration.
Congratulations.
In fact, we're embarking now on, we're doing another collaboration. We're doing a follow-up to Different Loving where we don't go through the what is BDSM and where does it come from, but we interview 24 of our original interviewees from 1991, 92,
mm-hmm.
and we track them down and we re-interview them and find out what is their journey in BDSM been for the past 23 years.
Wow, that's going to be great.
Because I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, they have stories to tell.
So after Different Loving, then you mm-hmm. wrote Come Hither, A Common Sense
right.
Guide to Kinky Sex. I found a quote online. Somebody was talking about on Amazon. They reviewed it and they said that if Different Loving was a scholarly overview of an exciting and unexplored new world, then Come Hither is like finding a chatty and knowledgeable tour guide who knows all the best spots in town. And I just thought that was a great way of summing it up.
That is. That's a really nice review, and they really got it, and that was the point. You know, Different Loving is, you know, I was teaching at NYU and I was writing Different Loving. I was very much in the academic frame of mind, and the work is kind of academic, which worked out well because now schools use it. But Come Hither was more, you want to do this stuff, or you're married to a straight partner and you're trying to explain it to them. You know, it was more just a feel comfortable, you know, feel good about it. And it's definitely more, I would say, mainstream oriented,
mm-hmm.
you know, newbie oriented, let's say.
And now, let's see, there's a trilogy you've written, or still in the process of
yeah.
writing?
I'm still in the process. I've written the first two volumes, and I hope to have the third one out next year in 2015. Well, what happened is, and I explain this in the book, is like when I was writing Different Loving and we were doing all that research, the biggest thing that occurred to me, because like I said, I was very much a nerdy academic literary person, is, and I knew from doing a lot of scholarly research in literature, it's like you have to question sources. You always have to question sources. So when I went to the original sources, like instead of reading what neo-Freudian said about Freudian theory, I went back and reread Freud, or I went back and read Havelock Ellis. I read like the original documents.
Mm-hmm.
And I came away from it saying to myself, they're fucking wrong. They're so damn wrong. You know, Freud based all of his sex theories on the assumption that women don't have a sex drive, independent of men. I mean, and all of his theories are kind of wrapped around that. It's such 19th century thinking.
Yeah.
You know? And what's really sad is because it is so much in line with Christian ideology
mm.
and basically what most faiths, the Jewish faith, even the Islamic faith, you know, it's so in line with what religions call appropriate behavior, appropriate sexual behavior,
right,
that people really think or really came to believe that science proved that, for example, monogamy is the only natural way to live,
mm.
or that science proved that men are more sexual than women. And it slowed the research in sexuality like 100 years.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, the ideas that are out there that people still, they don't even question, they just...
Yeah.
They've
People
heard it
still
enough.
Think masturbation is bad for you.
Yeah.
You know, in volume one, what I decided to do is, because these questions came to me, I basically had devoted, that's what it felt like, it's like I took on a 20-year mission. I didn't know it until mm-hmm. the 20 years were over, but it felt like suddenly when I was writing this, I thought, wow, you know, a 20-year mission to actually try and find all the most current science and see what it says about sex. In other words, what is actually factual that we know?
To revisit and say we're going to throw out all the preconceived.
Exactly. And look at it through the eyes of science, you know?
Great.
And in so doing, answer a lot of questions that came up for me. There are assumptions out there. I think I wrote about it in Come Hither that, 40% of all people are sexually dysfunctional.
Really?
Now, I look at a number like that. Well, that's the claim. But the thing is, what do they mean by that?
Yeah,
do they mean by dysfunctional that they don't get off fucking the same partner for 30 years in the same position? Because if I had to do that, I'd be dysfunctional.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people think we are dysfunctional, but I think we're probably normal.
I think we're normal and usually very highly functional.
We're having sex. We're happier.
Right, exactly. You know, having good sex makes you a happier person and a healthier one.
I believe that with my heart and soul and all the other parts of my anatomy.
No one has had the balls to really... I mean, if you type the benefits of orgasm into Google, you know, there are 100,000 stories. But I think I'm the first one to actually put it into a book, and that was Volume 1 of The Truth About Sex. Is basically, all of the science tells us that you should come a lot.
Sounds good to me.
My doctor says, if you don't use it, you'll lose it.
He's correct. It's a basic way of putting it, but there's more to it. Like, there are many studies now, not just one quirky study here and one quirky study there, but there's a whole literature which supports the medical fact that men reduce their chances of heart attack, stroke, and prostate cancer by 50% to 60% if they have orgasm. You know, I say jerk off because you can't always have that much sex with a partner, but, you know, 3 to 5 times a week.
Oh, my God, the beast is going to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
He's just smiling.
I'm sorry.
He's laying back in his chair smiling.
I'm making
there is, in men, there is a direct connection between the health of their penis and the health of their heart.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. You know, we have so much of this, and yet when you read, like something in Psychology Today, they're going to say something like making love rather than admitting, for example, that all your brain cares about is the orgasm and how you have it. They don't care if you need to hang upside down in a pair of bunny shoes or you're just jerking off to a photo of, you know, Nina Hartley.
Yeah, they don't care about the level of your intimacy with your vibrator. They just want to know,
They want, the full body experience, the positive brain chemistry, the endorphins, the oxytocin. That's what it's about.
Gloria, is there any data to say that women are healthier if they have orgasms?
Yes. Many of the same effects. The only fly in the ointment when you ask about women is that because of our Victorian disposition towards all things sexual, the emphasis all these years has been on male sexual health, not female.
So
they know how to deliver a baby, but they don't know how to give a woman back a functioning vagina after she's had a few kids.
Mm.
You know, as opposed to, let's say, like France, where after a woman gives birth, they actually then spend weeks with her on rejuvenating her vaginal muscles. You see what I mean? We have such a sex-negative take on everything in this culture. So we haven't really studied women enough, but I believe absolutely, based on what we do know, what science we do have, and anecdotal experience, and of course owning my own vagina, that women are at least as sexual as men. There's no doubt it's different. They experience their lust differently because their bodies are different. But women are just as highly sexed as men. And that there are just as many benefits, certainly in terms of feeling mellow, feeling happier about, you know, your levels of depression, everything in your body. It's the same biology when it comes to brain chemistry.
That is so true.
Yep.
I am looking here at other things. You know, you don't just write the books. You've published hundreds of articles and essays on sexuality, and in 2013, I think you were named one of the 10 best sex and dating experts by dating.com. That's pretty. Did they give you a nice little certificate or something?
I could have taken a site badge. And I could have blogged for them, but, you know, I'm too busy.
A lot of times the media will come to you when they've got a weird
sexual
case.
Yeah, that I do. Well, it's kind of funny because I have a split mainstream identity. The reason that I wrote With the Truth About Sex, this trilogy thing, volume one is really for anybody over the age of 15, straight or kinky, because I think a lot of kinky people, honestly, are not in touch with their basic sexuality and still struggle with, you know, they're doing kink, but when it comes to masturbation, they can't handle it, really. So, I mean, volume one is really for everybody to just get a sense that you have power over your own sexuality. You have the power to have orgasms. You have the power to be happy. You have the power to improve your physical health.
People,
you know?
You're right. People need to know that. You got to start with that foundation before you can...
You have to have, right. Because until you're right with yourself, it's very hard to be a good sex partner to somebody else.
Very, very true.
Well, and our society has such sex-negative ideals that sometimes you aren't able to get in touch, but you find the kink and you haven't fully developed the sexual even before the kink comes into your world.
Exactly right. And, you know, and I do, you know, sadly see some kink relationships fail on those grounds because, you know, the people are not even that good at giving each other orgasms.
That's sad.
I'll go out on a limb here and make in my soapbox. We don't talk about sex until somebody turns the magic age of 18. And the human body has started doing its things long before this time, and we're providing no knowledge to people at these formative periods of their life until that magic number of 18 when the Pandora's box opens up for them.
Yes and no. That's the legal age, of course. But I, you know, looking at it from a long view as a sexologist, I mean, I think we're born sexual. We're sexual even in the womb. We're born sexual, and we go through a lot of phases and stages of identity as a sexual being. And I think that, honestly, it doesn't really shake out until you're over 25. Because I think between the ages of 18 and 25, or let's say really 15 and 25, you're such a walking bag of hormones.
I call it testosterone poisoning in men. They're boys then.
Well, and it's the same. You see, this is why, you know, we should study women's biology more, because I really think when I think back to my youth, I think I was estrogen poison. I mean, I could not get enough. You know, I mean,
well,
I was,
you know, that's...
I was active. You know, I was out there. I always wanted, you know, my ideal was always, you know, multiple partners and multiple opportunities a week.
I came along in a very Southern Baptist upbringing. And it, I took it for granted that I was never going to have sex until I got married. But on the other hand, I had this huge curiosity, and I accidentally discovered masturbation at about the age of 11. And I used to dress up in my mother's Fredericks of Hollywood lingerie.
That's so awesome.
That I found tucked in a back drawer, and would then find my father's pornography in his sock drawer. And if my parents ever realize what I was doing, but I was in this really religious setup where, you know, we had to go one place in fantasy, but had no expectation that it would ever come to a reality until I went off to college, and then all bets were off.
You know, so how did you suddenly change? When was your enlightenment?
I went off to college, and I lost my virginity to the first boy that kissed me because I just lost my mind. It's
yeah. No, I mean, you literally did. I know, you know, just from looking at the science of it, kids are just, you know, until we're in our late 20s, we're just full of that stuff. We are full of chemical, you know, brain chemistry that says mate, mate now, mate now, mate now. You might mate with that one. You could mate with that one. Mate now, mate now, mate now.
Get it while you can.
But isn't that nature? Well, nature says that's what you do. That's what the birds and bees do.
You don't have a choice in it. It's really biologically wired into you. You know, it's a trigger with your own, you know, whatever. Some people don't have much hormonal activity. Some people are the poster boys for testosterone, you know, and they go seven times a day if they could.
I think women have it so much harder, though, because we get so many conflicting messages that there's something wrong with you if you feel this way.
Well, and this is why I think that, you know, even getting clear sexological pictures of women even today can be very difficult, because everything is shaped by your expectation. I mean, like, going back to Freud, if you assume that women are not the people who want sex, but that sex is something men want, men always want sex, right? That's, you hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If women were allowed to want sex, if when you started to feel a little bit in the mood, you had a group of buddies drinking beer and trying to set you up with somebody, you know, women would be different too. But women are told, don't think about it. Marriage isn't about that. That's not why you get married. Sex isn't that important in a marriage. These are lies.
Well, that sex means you're not a nice person. Nice girls don't do that.
Why not?
Well, that's just what they've always told us. And I think it goes back to male patriarchy trying to control women's sexuality as a way of controlling women, period.
I'm a very feministic person, but I will also say that women are complicit in their own oppression.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They've embraced those chains.
That men couldn't take that power if women didn't give it up. And women give it up for the same reasons that men are literally torn up inside and think they're sex addicts if they jerk off.
Mm.
You know, it's because the social forces, a combination of religion and government with its laws, all make us feel like criminals if we don't grow up totally virginal until that time we're ready to marry that one perfect person, and then never want to do anything but have missionary position intercourse with them.
So that you can have children.
That is how people are, so you can have children, because that's the real point of sex.
Yeah.
That's how people are raised, and they believe it, hook, line, and sinker. And they don't stop to question, which is, you know, why people like me are in the world, you know. We question. We say, really? Who said that?
Yeah.
Who thinks that's a good idea in the first place?
Well, thank God that you did question. It really was a good thing for the world in general that people like you and others were willing to do that.
And I feel like, you know, I'm actually part of a movement of people who have finally questioned everything. Otherwise, I think that the victories we have seen in gay marriage rights, for example,
mm-hmm.
is people questioning everything.
Yeah, saying,
you know,
why not?
Why is it so bad if, they're gay people and they just love each other and they're not forcing anything on us? What is so bad about it?
It's a time to ask those questions.
It is.
Now, I've got another question for you, because this is really, tell me about the Swiss cheese pervert.
Get called in on the odd ones sometimes.
Yeah, I
sometimes privately for consultation and sometimes publicly for comment. There was a gentleman who claimed to have a fetish for Swiss cheese.
And this was in Philadelphia, right?
It was in Philadelphia. And the thing is, you know, I'm never shocked by unusual fetishes.
Never?
Because, no.
Nobody's
because
ever...
anybody... There's, I forget it, I'm quoting the book, but rule, whatever it is, 34 of the internet or something, you know, if it exists, someone wants to screw it, I think, is the rule. You know, it's just so funny. It's like I found the other day, like, this little letter to an editor from a magazine from 1941. A guy had a fetish for cork-soled boots.
Oh, my.
I'm like, you don't even see corks. I mean, you know. Goodbye with his fetish, you know? But he obviously came from a time or was in a place where a lot of people wore these cork-soled fetish, you know, shoes, and he thought they were the bee's knees, right?
Wow.
And when I was doing a lot of that original research, like, I found people had fetishes in the 19th century for shoe buttons.
Wow.
Or bicycle accessories.
I'm still stuck on the Swiss cheese. I'm not quite sure where that goes.
Now, this guy, all right, so he has a food fetish, right? General class is food fetish. Food fetishes are pretty common. People, often it's a little more luxurious, and they, you know, they bring whipped cream to bed or something, you know.
But this guy was driving around Philadelphia?
Right. Now, the thing is, he wasn't just your average fetishist. He was a fetishist who was an exhibitionist and probably wanted to be caught. And I think his thrill was like a flasher, horrifying people and getting negative reactions out of them. There's no way, you know, they said in the article he was offering women $50 to rub his dick with the piece of cheese.
Okay.
He came with the cheese, right?
Okay,
I mean, he literally came with the cheese, but
no,
I mean, he brought his own cheese. Yeah, but he brought his own cheese.
You know, that's just that's just wrong. Being in Philadelphia and going Swiss, he needs cream cheese.
Come on.
Anyway, oh my gosh, right. So he would drive around and slow the car and say, you know, here I am, here's my penis, it's naked, by the way, and here's a slice of cream, Swiss cheese, you prefer to, you know, Swiss cheese, and rub me off, I'll give you $50. But here's the thing, you and I, and anyone who's had sex, knows that you could go to the crappy part of town and give some working girl $50 and, you know, she'll give you a blowjob with Swiss cheese.
Yeah, she'll dress, you know, herself in Swiss cheese for you.
She'll dress, you know, you give her the money, she'll do it. And no, so it's not really about him fulfilling that fetish fantasy. He's a special case of somebody who's sociopathic, is what I'm thinking.
He's wanting, you know, the shock. Wants the shock reaction.
Yeah, and do no, and have non-consensual engagement, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the big thing, you know, and for that reason alone, although it's hilarious and funny to me, and I mean, if he did it to me, it would, I'd probably just say some dominatrix thing to him. But at the same time, he is a social, he is a menace and a threat to society, because he's antisocial, because you don't go around and scare people.
Right.
It's not nice.
And it could possibly escalate to something else. And
it could, because anyone who would do that is clearly not in his right mind.
And anybody, you know, he's also ruining it for all the perfectly sane, happy, well-adjusted people who are turned on by dairy products. He's being a bad role model out there. Well, you know, one bad pervert gives us all a bad name.
I don't believe that.
You don't think so?
At all. No, I think I'm at another level of, you know, BDSM consciousness. Let me take you with
me. Take me there. Take me there,
I want to take you there. Okay, you know, all right. My parents are Holocaust survivors. My whole childhood, you know, if a Jew ever did anything bad, it looked bad for the Jews.
Mm.
They quivered in their boots because they always felt like, you know, the Nazis would come and get us if they found out that Jews were misbehaving. And now I'm 58, and there are a lot of bad Jews out there. You know, Bernie Madoff, right? What else? I mean, you know, the or bad Jew, right? It doesn't say anything about other Jews, and people don't take, I mean, people who are anti-Semitic take it that way.
Yeah.
Well, but so you don't, I doubt that you now blame all your Jewish friends for being part of some Zionist, worldwide Zionist financial conspiracy, right?
No, but, so you don't feel, I am with you to the point of, yeah, it shouldn't reflect badly on other people just because one person who happens to belong to the same group.
No, look, we are a large group of people. There are crazy people in our midst.
But you don't think that we have to be
abnormal if there weren't.
You don't feel like we need to be really worried about those people who do get out there and make a fool of themselves and give other people.
They're not our problem.
Okay. I'm just
our problem are people who are allegedly consensual members of the scene,
mm-hmm.
who've come to the classes, who've gotten the education, who play with consenting partners, and who hurt them. Those are the real predators.
Mm-hmm.
The people who exploit submissives, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I know you know what I mean.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
You know,
unfortunately.
But just for the newbies, you know, there are people who call themselves dominant, but who don't really give you BDSM pleasure, but they do take advantage of you.
Yeah.
And call it BDSM.
Those masters.
I consider those people to be genuinely dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, or people.
They're internet masters. You know, I am Master Lord High Poobah, and you will bow to me. And that's what a lot of people are subjected to, especially when they're new.
Yes, they are. And I think almost every newbie goes through that because, you know, sometimes those sociopathic types of people are very exciting at the beginning because they sound, you know, they make themselves sound so great.
Well, when you've been you've been looking
right,
forever.
Right, and you want to believe. Yeah. Right. And especially if you're submissive, you're looking for the person you can give control to.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really thinking, you know, you're thinking with your sex chemistry, not your logical mind. You're thinking with the mating opportunity I've been longing for my entire life. That one person I'll feel those special feelings with, you know. And so to me, they represent the real threat, whereas people who go off the rail and have fetishes, you know, they're not really part of the BDSM world. They were not really one of us. Because if they were one of us, they wouldn't be doing that.
Interesting.
So I think what you have to watch out for are the wolves in sheep clothing in our midst. Because people like that, they seldom have anything to do with the scene. There was just a case yesterday I posted about a woman said she was a dominatrix and met another woman and claimed she was giving her lesson. And the next thing you know, the woman. With a bat.
With a bat.
With a bat of ball. Right. And all of this is happening in a trailer park.
TV is just waiting for this.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and the thing is, yes, it's ridiculous and it's sad that it involved kinky people. But I'll tell you something, that goes on every day in every trailer park among vanilla people.
That's true.
And people don't blame the S&M.
Well, I guess it's just those of us who are still, I don't know if my being in the Deep South has an impact on worrying more about how I'm seen as a member of this community. It's a little harder, I think, down in the South where there's a church on every corner and it's just still very hard to come out of the closet as a kinkster.
Kate, you're in Nashville. There's four churches on every corner.
That's true. Yes.
One on each corner.
Yeah, and a lot of us, a lot of Americans, I mean, I live in a rural area of Georgia now.
That's right. You're in Georgia. I forgot about that.
Right. And, you know, locally, I keep a very low profile. You know, I'm just a regular member of society. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't wear my leathers to, you know, get eggs at Ingles.
I bet you'd make a lot of friends if you did, though, you know?
I just don't want to get that kind of attention. You know? Have Bubba's trailing after
exactly.
me. Bubba's who read 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh,
that's
Lord.
My nightmare.
Do you get a lot of weird
Is that
email?
Because
I'm curious
oh,
that you're
Oh, honey,
you're very,
I get a lot of weird email, yes.
You make yourself fairly accessible through your website and online, and I just thought, my God, you must get some of the weirdest.
You know, oddly, it's my own crazy plan for trying to not attract stalkers, because I think stalkers are attracted to people who seem really exclusive and hard to get to.
Mm-hmm. So if you're there,
you know, if you
they can
talk
to you.
To me,
yeah.
Right. If you really want to talk to me, you can find, you know, or email, you know, I'm easy and I don't have a buffer of staff answering stuff. You know, I just don't tolerate bullshit, that's all. You know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but if you really have a reason to talk to me, whether it's something about a group, you know, talking to a group or working with me in therapy or sharing some article you saw or whatever it may be, I'm really, really easy to find. And I think in a way it takes away somewhat from the feeling of desperation that other people's fans have. You
yeah,
know what I mean?
I see your point, yeah. If you can't get to somebody that it can make you want to get to them all the more.
Right. You know, I'm like very transparent and really very easy. And it's worked so far.
Yeah, I'd say it's doing good. Because you also do, you are an active sex therapist.
Right.
What exactly is a board certified sexologist? How does that differ from a...
Okay, well, sexologists are very different from anything else. We're not psychiatrists, social workers, or psychologists, even though some of my colleagues also have double degrees in those fields.
Mm-hmm.
We are specifically trained in sex. That's what we study. We don't study psychology per se,
mm-hmm.
although in my practice I studied a lot of psychology because I offer kind of a very holistic approach because I believe that you have to be fully integrated psychologically, emotionally, spiritually with your sexuality to have the best sex life. You know, you have to feel good in all the parts of you. We're specifically trained in sex, and what that means is that, for the most part, a lot of people, they have very simple sex problems. Typical people, they have difficulties with function. It's the most common problem.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get it up, or they can't get wet, or they can't have an orgasm. Everything is physically functioning, so what's actually going on? So that's where sex therapists come in, and sometimes it's behavioral treatment where you give them assignments to... You know, I have masturbatory assignments for women who've,
mm-hmm.
adult women who've never touched themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're the ones often who have the biggest problem with having orgasms because they don't even know what feels right. You know, they never really explored it in themselves, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes people like that, that's just one or two conversations, and really what they're coming to you for is sex ed. That's what I think.
That's a great way of looking at it, because you're right. I've run into people myself, in just friends. Mm-hmm. I had a college roommate who was very sexually active, but when we got on the topic of masturbation one day, she admitted that she had never done it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, you need to.
Yeah.
You know, I'll leave the room if you need me to, but you need to explore that.
Right. And so sex therapists are the ones who will talk to you about it to the degree of depth that you need help with. In other words, if you're so shy you don't even know how to do it, mm-hmm. you know, we'll explain how it's done. We'll tell you how other people do it. Or, you know, I don't personally do hands-on, but there are sex therapists who work hands-on. You mm-hmm. know, they will show you techniques if you come in with a partner. You know, they'll allow you to experiment with techniques. With me, it's actually all talk therapy. You know, I work on, as I said, for some people it's just behavioral, but for most of the kinky people I meet, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Because the brain is the biggest sex organ.
Yeah, and, you know, again, we were all raised in sex-negative culture. We all have these lowered expectations about sex. We all tend to think of sex as, you know, a lot of people don't come to me because they feel like it's so complicated, I dread it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I open that can of worms, oh, my God.
They don't know where those worms will crawl off to.
Right. Because people are, to me, that's because they're really scared of sex. They really see sex as something that can hurt you.
Yeah.
It has the power to hurt you. And that's so much what we get out of church.
I think that you have done some really great things. And there was something on your website that I really liked. It said, I know that unconventional choices and alternative relationships can work. I'm the living proof of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're poly and kinky, and it seems to be working well for you, and that gives us all hope that we can do it too. So thanks.
You know, I believe that this is our new evolution as a community,
mm-hmm.
the BDSMers, because, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was really in formation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, meaning we were all forming, we were first coming out, we were first starting to see that maybe we wouldn't get busted the minute we had a party. I mean, these were things that were really terrible in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Clubs, a lot of clubs and a lot of pro doms got busted.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, there was an event, Attleboro, Massachusetts.
They called it the Paddleboro.
The Paddleboro.
Yeah, where they just busted. Right, Paddleboro. You remember that, where cops just busted in on a noise complaint, arrested them for consensual adult spanking. Those kinds of things really scare people and shut them down, you know, and end relationships. But I think now we're at a place where people are saying, you know, it isn't just about the play. It's all about the much deeper, intimate connection you can have with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people are looking more and more, I think, for the long-term relation than before.
I think so. I think you're right.
You know, I think the emphasis was more on, oh, my God, an opportunity to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as people's expectations have risen and they see more people managing to live this life, they say, why can't I live that life?
It can be incorporated into who you are instead of being something that you keep in a closet for special occasions.
Right. It can be part of your reality, even if it's a reality you only share with one other partner. You can still have that reality at home.
Yes, you can, thank God.
Even when we go out as a triad, we all wear wedding rings, but we're not out there, you know, dressed in role and acting obviously in role to others.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're sitting at the table, we might make Jennifer, our slave girl, you know, fetch things, but nobody knows. And when we're with her parents, we don't do that.
Yeah.
We don't treat her that way. You know, I mean, we moderate it, but at home, it's lifestyle.
Yeah, that is just a great thing to know that people can live it.
Why not?
I am so happy that we got a chance to talk to you tonight.
Well, thank you. This is such a great talk. You guys are so smart and interesting.
Oh, well, shucks.
I thought it was the other way around, but that's just me.
Okay, we're all smart.
We're all smart and happy.
And that means you probably have a smart and interesting audience, because, you know,
We hope all you smart people out there are listening.
Well, they must be smart because they're listening, see?
That's true. If they're smart,
never argue with the dominatrix.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am.
And I'm not going to argue with the things you're saying. It's all good. We've had some really record numbers here so far, and we hope to keep it going. So thank you for your input.
Well, that's wonderful, guys. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to episode 17 of The Kinky Cast. Today, Kate Kinsey joined in the conversation with Gloria Brame. We want to hear from you with your comments or questions. So email us, questions@kinkycast.com, or call and leave a voicemail at 916-KINKY69. If you leave a contact number, we will try to reach you to join us on the show. Some listeners want to remain completely anonymous, so we have the Bashful tab on our webpage. Just type your message and hit send. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and Cassie, I'm Max. See you next week, when we speak with a West Coast sex worker.